Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really, really exciting guest. You know, we're going to be talking about following your instinct, unexpected events, you know, how you do well by obviously, you know, aligning the impact also with business value. You know, I think that really understanding the drive and the vision, you know, and being able to get those two is really incredible, and especially in the world today. And again, the building, the scaling, financing, I mean, he's done all types of good stuff. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Christian Talmash.
Hey, Alejandro. It's a pleasure to meet you.
So originally born in Long Island, but fairly quick, you know, you moved to Maine. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Sure. Yeah. Living up in Maine, we lived in a pretty rural part of the country. Back in the woods, very close to Sugarloaf Mountain Ski Resort, that's really the only landmark up there. And I got to say, I loved it. It's a really special place. I have a lot of near and dear friends. Maybe not the most challenging school environment, but yeah, a lot of wonderful things.
So tell us about your ski racing appetite, because I'm sure that has shaped you quite a bit, you know, when it comes to really being an entrepreneur, getting out there, you know, wanting to be number one, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah, it definitely fosters an appetite for competition. That's for sure. And something I think there's a strong corollary between the risk-taking, the adrenaline rush of skiing and putting yourself into these really difficult situations where there's a high potential for injury and there's a lot of things that can go wrong, and you're really trusting in your own ability to see you through. And I feel like building companies, starting companies, it's a lot of that same leap. You know, you really don't know what the future holds and you're taking an immense risk, all under the premise that you're going to figure this thing out and you're going to pull it all together just in time and hopefully see a really exciting outcome. But there's a big uncertainty as you go.
So you went to college, and obviously you had that love for math and science. So there was no other than some type of engineering, you know, degree. So walk us through what was the desire there.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of career paths that I didn't even realize were options growing up. I felt like, because I loved math and science so much and really excelled there, I had a deep interest in art and design. I thought that meant that I was going to be an architect. I thought that was the only kind of viable career path. And so, because I was so focused on skiing and the schools that had D1 ski programs did not have architecture programs, I thought that the next best thing was like, okay, I'm going to study engineering. I'm going to study physics and studio art, and I'm going to leave with some capable degrees and skill sets in those areas. And then I'll go back and I'll study architecture and I'll go on to, you know, define my career with that.
So then in your case, you know, you decided that being an architect or being in the architect world, you know, was the choice after getting your degree. I mean, out of all things, why did you choose, you know, that direction, that path?
Yeah, you know, like I thought, it combined a lot of the passions of that art and design combined with technical capabilities and engineering. And again, I think it spoke to just a lack of awareness of what the different, you know, career paths even looked like. I do love spatial design. I do love thinking through structural systems. But as I got into that space and I really leapt into this job with, you know, both eyes open, I joined early stages and just kind of through default ended up being promoted really quickly. Firsthand experience leading, building a commercial, large scale commercial building, and realized, wait a minute, this is not what it's all cracked up to be. I think there's got to be other more interesting spaces.
And obviously there was a podcast there that kind of like turned everything around for you.
That's right. Yeah. While I was working and while I was busy heads down, you know, drawing and building construction details, I was listening to a lot of different podcasts because it's a great way to, you know, pass the time while you're doing these kind of creative activities. And I really fell in love with the Entrepreneurial Thought Leaders podcast from Stanford. I was listening to folks like Drew Houston from Dropbox, like Ben Horowitz from Andreessen Horowitz, Larry and Sergey, these people giving these really inspiring speeches. And it made me feel like, wait a minute, I love creative problem solving. I love technical problem solving. I really want to be building companies. I want to be an entrepreneur. This is maybe what I've been looking for. And it completely changed the course of my career. Rather than looking for grad schools and architecture, I began looking at programs at Stanford. I ended up going there to study human-centered design, product design, and taking a lot of business classes along the way. So that just really stoked this entrepreneurial passion.
You know, it's really interesting too that you got the entrepreneurial passion, and this whole experience of Stanford, you know, really got you more than anything into joining the startup world. As a result of that, you started getting involved with the VR space with either investors, you know, on the investment side, or with River Studios, or for example, with Boom. But ultimately, Boom became your segue into building Oliver Space. So walk us through the sequence of events that needed to happen for you to ultimately say, hey, you know what, I'm going to take ownership of my own destiny.
Yeah. It's a great question. You know, I jumped into a couple startups immediately after school, got some firsthand exposure to what does it mean to build a company, all the good, bad, and ugly involved. It really takes a lot of will, and there's a lot of things you have to design on the fly. The analogy of putting together the airplane as it's falling down couldn't be more apt, but it helped build confidence, I think, in understanding what does it actually take to get a business off the ground. And I felt like after a certain period of time, why shouldn't I just be doing this myself? I feel like I know what it takes and, you know, have the skills to make this happen.
So tell us too about following your instincts, because I know that you're big into that. You know, obviously many, many shifts and turns, you know, in your career in terms of spaces, industries, and things. So you always look at where's the energy and passion. So walk us through that a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, you look at this career path, you see, you know, some very technical disciplines, some art disciplines, you see architecture, and then you see this trajectory of different startups and problem solving along the way. And I think it might feel a little circuitous. I don't know that it's necessarily like a clear linear trajectory, but the way I've made those decisions along the way has really been informed by intuition. It's been formed by passionate and focusing on the areas that I'm just finding the most energy. And I have to say, I feel like it's served me really well over the years. It's been a great way to make sure that I'm incredibly engaged in whatever I'm working on at the time. And I know that whenever there's a lot of energy derived from the activity, from the building, from learning, I tend to just do it and focus and obsess about it at a much higher degree. And then the rate of learning increases. And so I don't know that you need to know what your 5, 10, 15 year plan is to see really good outcomes along the way and have a great learning experience.
So then with this, you know, essentially tell us, you know, what happened, you know, how do you get into it with Oliver Space, and what was that journey to being like, you know, this looks like it's going to be the business model for us?
Yeah, it's a cognitive leap for one. We jumped into the space, my co-founder and I, when there were already a couple of competitive products on the market. This is mostly in the category of rental furniture at the time. It was becoming this interesting space. We had seen folks like Rent-A-Center in the past have very high success with rental models. But what we said is like, wait a minute, this is an old, tired model that is a little predatory in nature, to be honest, with very high, you know, very high rates. Can we modernize this? Can we make it a little bit more contemporary for today's user? My co-founder and I, we both moved multiple times, you know, every year, basically, since we had left for college. And we said, wait a minute, your needs are constantly changing. The demands on your space are constantly changing. Maybe you're adding, losing roommates, having children, modifying your home for all sorts of various reasons. This model of buying furniture and keeping it for 10 years doesn't quite make sense. And so the fundamentals felt really good. It felt like we were solving a problem that had a visceral need. And it was really easy to look around to peers in every direction and see how this was applicable to them. And so we set out with that problem. We had a couple of templates to work off of, but really the challenge at that point became, how do we build something 5, 10, you know, 15x better than what's already out there? And we focused on holistic design. We focused on incredible ease and convenience and user experience. And all of those things took investment, right? All of those things were expensive. Fortunately, the margins in furniture are really high. So we were able to take that, rather than offering sales, we were able to take that return, put it directly into the activities that we were doing, but only to so much degree. So we really had to get scrupulous about how we managed our operations internally. And we helped add a ton of leverage and lower our OPEX by investing in technology that made it really easy to do all these activities. And so that's where I spent the vast majority of my time with the business. And we were able to see some really meaningful returns over a short period of time, 4 years, about 18 million ARR. Things were growing fast.
So you guys also raised 56 million throughout the journey of the company. So what were the financing cycles like? How was it like going through the motions?
Yeah, it's always hard. Anyone who tells you otherwise has either had a phenomenally lucky experience or doesn't know what they're talking about. It never really gets easier. There's always a lot of challenges with fundraising. Sometimes the rounds come together, but the stakes get higher. So you hit your metrics, things are moving really well, you get really excited about the business, but the world around you, the expectations have all changed. And so every stage of the way, you've constantly got to prove yourself. You've constantly got to sell this vision, and you're going to hear a lot of rejection. You're going to hear a lot of no's along the way. And one of the biggest risks that I see founders and entrepreneurs running into during that time is letting that become too discouraging, taking their eyes off the prize, losing sight of the intuition that they have about their customer and the problem that they're solving, where the opportunity is, and immediately throwing that stuff out the window because some investor who's looking at it for the first time says, I don't think that's going to work. Or have you thought about this totally different aspect of your business? And then before you know it, you're changing gears, you're changing product roadmap, you're making a bunch of decisions based on really loose informed data because you've heard a couple people suggest it. And you got to really stick to your guns, know what you're selling, know your customer inside and out. And don't let, for lack of a better word, don't let the haters distract you from the end goal.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. There's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So in your case, in the end, you guys, as you were saying, you achieved the 18 million ARR. But there was a series of unexpected events, that they hit you guys, when COVID, hit the fan. So talk to us. What happened there?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this comes back to it's always difficult. We felt like we were in a very good position less than a year after our founding. We went out to raise our Series A again. We were already doing a million ARR, I believe within about seven, eight months of launch. We had a super talented team. We had great customer reviews. A lot of things were all pointing towards this is going to be a monster round. As we start to go out to market, I remember distinctly, I'd just gotten back. I'd gotten married and we didn't go on. We took a very brief little couple day mini moon and then knew we got to come back and focus on fundraising because we had such a great opportunity right then and there. And we're lining up meetings left and right. Pretty shortly thereafter, this growing rumors of something happening in China that felt very far away, that seemed like it was problematic, but not something that we would have to worry about here in the US, very quickly became something we were worrying about in the US. And it was scaling. We were hearing a lot of reports about how devastating this was. And meetings were just dropping off of our calendar left and right. Meanwhile, there's all sorts of information. Everyone is very unclear about what's going on. There's rumors that this is something that can live on cardboard and other surfaces for, you know, months at a time. All of our manufactured goods are coming from China at that time. And we said, we took a hard look at each other and said, wait a minute, did we just lose this business because of some act of God that we never could have predicted, even though all the signals were pointing towards a massive success story? And it was humbling, to say the least. It was a great reminder that you need to fight every single day. You can't rest on your laurels. You need to reinvent yourself constantly if you're going to grow and scale a business. And so we had to pause. We had to pause operations briefly. We paused our marketing. We took a hard look at the world and said, like, what are we going to do? My co-founder and I took massive pay cuts to try to retain as much of the team as possible. But we frankly had no idea what the future was going to hold. And only with the benefit of some time, we continued on building product. Our operations and marketing team said, you know, strategize how might we operate in this new world. And shortly thereafter, we started to hear Wayfair reporting their best quarter ever. Amazon starting to report massive furniture sales. And we said, wait a minute, this is maybe our time to shine. So we started leaning back into it. We start to do deliveries. We're doing it in a much more controlled manner. We're not going into people's homes in the same way. And soon we started to realize this is actually a huge tailwind for us. People are thinking a lot about redesigning their homes and buying furniture. So it was a dark moment and a scary moment, but again, perseverance pulled through. And ultimately we were back to the races and we ended up having a really good couple quarters thereafter.
So then what happened, you know, next?
Next, you know, we scaled the business and we grew quite large. We started to run into a challenge of who actually is going to acquire this business. Once you have become so heavily capitalized, now all of a sudden there becomes a very real question. There's relatively few buyers in, you know, the retail and furniture space. And the question becomes, what are they actually purchasing you for? What is it that they're going to get from acquiring you? Is it your customer cohort? It's certainly not our catalog. They have much broader teams working on their furniture selection, much more refined strategies there. Is it our operations? You know, they have large distribution centers nationwide. And what we started to realize, it's this underlying software tooling package that allows you to do returned goods very easily, to build this compelling customer experience where people can shop online and have products swapped in and out very easily, where we can refurbish them in the behind the scenes and then sell them again like new. And so all of that technology was where we started to hang our hat. We ran into some challenges because this was a model shift. And when you are building a big retail oriented company, the tendency is to raise a lot of venture debt so that you can finance that inventory, which we of course did. And we had, you know, compelling terms. But when we start to switch our business model, that became a point where a lot of these venture debt providers could actually say, well, this is something that we're not comfortable with. We're going to actually ask you to pay off all of that principal. And you got to think about the time frame here. We're in the middle of late 2022, early 2023. Financial markets are not looking very exciting. We're seeing a massive market downturn, a very big correction across technology. And very shortly thereafter, we start to see big banks. We're seeing bank runs. We're seeing Silicon Valley Bank running into challenges. And so venture debt providers start to look wherever they can capture any sort of revenue. And so despite the fact that things were looking very exciting, we start to get capital calls, people asking to pay down that principal, which we did not have enough capital in the bank to do. And shortly thereafter, we're forced to default. So again, another one of those reminders that it never gets easier, no matter how exciting the product experience looks, no matter how good the metrics are. It's an act of perseverance, and there will always be some major challenge that's pushing against the success of the business, trying to fight with you to help you, you know, try to hold you down. So you got to persevere through all this stuff.
What was that day where you guys decided that it was time to pull the plug? How was that for you?
Oh, it was terrible. It was incredibly disappointing. I think, you know, after a certain scale, you start to think, you know, there's a range of different outcomes that you might see, but you're no longer worried about an outcome. You're no longer worried about a complete business failure. It really becomes a matter of economics and, you know, is this going to be a really exciting opportunity for me and my family, or is this going to be something that, like, we see meaningful return from? But to come to think that we're going to walk away empty-handed from this one was a big bummer for all of us.
No kidding. So obviously the chapter comes to an end. And with when a chapter closes, a new chapter opens. And in this case, you know, it ended up being Dispatch, and with Dispatch Goods. So talk to us about Dispatch Goods. What are you guys doing at Dispatch Goods? You know, I know that you guys have raised about $8 million. You know, we obviously hope to hear something new that I know that is going to come out, you know, soon. But again, talk to us about what you guys are doing with Dispatch Goods, and then also with aligning impact with business value.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we're very excited to announce some recent round closures for Dispatch Goods. But for now, we're not going to talk too much about any of those details. It was a very exciting business. After Oliver, I spent a little bit of time really focusing on climate and the different opportunities in that sector as a whole, which is really, you know, a microcosm of the economy as a whole. And where were there really interesting places to play? Where were there interesting places where you could provide meaningful climate impact? You know, my wife and I, this is very important to us. We have children. We see the writing on the wall. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on that front. How do you do that? And how do you accomplish those types of goals while still wanting to build a successful business, still being a competitive entrepreneur, as we mentioned before, and wanting to have a really great financial outcome? And I have to say, there's very few businesses that I've seen that actually fulfill both of those goals incredibly well. You see a lot of very impact-driven companies that don't have economics that pencil out, they have major scalability concerns. They're very much early kind of research-oriented ideas that haven't yet been proven in the market. And then you have great business models that are kind of cursory climate-related. Maybe they touch on it in a, you know, practical way, or maybe it's a lot of greenwashing and it's difficult to tell sometimes until you really start to kick the tires. Dispatch for me was, you know, one of a very short list of companies that actually fulfilled both of those goals in a very compelling way. Dispatch is taking a circular approach in the same way that we had applied circularity to Oliver as a mechanism for, you know, eking out meaningful returns and better utilizing inventory and products that have been, you know, mass produced. Dispatch has been doing a similar exercise with an industrial focus. We've been focusing on secondary packaging, particularly in the world of cold chain, where these products are very expensive line items for any perishable goods. So think meal and grocery, D2C meal and grocery, home health products like Ozempic and Wegovy, any of these different products that are getting delivered to your doorstep that have temperature sensitivity. They're all getting filled with gel packs, insulation, a lot of these products to help keep them at safe temperatures. And so all of this stuff has been optimized for single use, right? You pack your boxes and your packages with all of this extra material and consumer throws it all away. One, that's an expensive line item. It's about 10% of revenue for these companies. Two, it's a terrible customer experience. We talk to end users of our enterprise customers all the time. One of the single things that they report the most is not the sustainability benefit of reusing these things, but it's the convenience of being able to just give it back and not having to think about what to do with these goopy chemical gel packs that they aren't really comfortable taking apart and throwing away. There is a waste component. There is a guilt component to just using this product and throwing it all away. It's a lot of material. And a lot of people just don't even like breaking down boxes. They run out of space. They live in managed buildings or apartments where there isn't that much room in their recycling bins. And so being able to give all this stuff back turnkey and knowing that it's going to a good use and it's going to get used again, I think is very gratifying for people. So basically, we can hit on three major bullets here, which are cheaper for our enterprise customers substantially, which they love, obviously, a better customer experience, which their consumers love, and so then they love, and has all of this added green benefit just because, you know, by nature of the business model, you're reusing these things 5 to 15 times. It's inherently far more sustainable than, you know, buying this stuff overseas, putting it on a ship, freighting it over here from China, and then throwing it away at the end of its cycle. So it really felt like a rare breed of business that actually has compelling economics, high potential for scale, and an exciting climate impact along the way.
That's amazing. So I guess now, you know, let's say I was to put you into a time machine. And I bring you back in time. You know, let's say I bring you back in time to that moment that you were thinking about, you know, maybe starting Oliver Space, you know, and it's 2018, okay? Let's say you're able to have a chat with your younger self and you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
One piece of advice before jumping into that business. One, I'd say it's going to be really hard. I don't think that would have surprised me at the time. I don't think I would appreciate what that actually means. It's one thing to know conceptually. It's another thing to live and breathe. When the book stops at you, there are no more excuses. There is no more, I'm going to look for another job. It becomes, you know, it becomes a huge part of your life. And so knowing that there is just that high degree of dedication, again, I don't think I would understand, but I would want to hear it reminded to me. Maybe I would trust my older self, my, you know, future self. The other piece, you know, maybe a good place to think about is just the importance of culture, the importance of bringing on the right early hires. Talent is obviously incredibly important. That's something that I think is easy for everybody to wrap their brains around. But that culture gets defined with every new employee. And whether it's implicit, whether it's explicit or not, there will be a culture. And so knowing who are these people who you really love working with, who are these people who you can throw a million problems at the wall and, you know, spend late nights, weekends, just grinding through really difficult scenarios with, and, you know, kind of trust with your life in a bunch of different ways. That's what the people you want to be founding these companies with. That's what's going to help you be successful. I can't say enough about what a game changer that kind of attitude is.
So, Christian, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Sure. Shoot me a message. You can respond to me either on LinkedIn or shoot me a message at Dispatch Goods, Christian at dispatchgoods.com, especially if you're interested in, we're going to be hiring for a lot of new roles very shortly here, everything across engineering, data, operations, finance. Shoot me a message. I'd love to talk to you. If you're interested, want to do some very big, impactful work, yeah, that's the best way.
I love it. Well, hey, well, Christian, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. Really, really appreciate it. You know, it has been really an honor to have you with us. So thank you so, so much.
Alejandro, thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation and, you know, I love the podcast. Thanks for the help.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.